And now from the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
8 years ago, then New Jersey Governor Chris Christie shook up the political world by dropping out of the race for president to endorse Donald Trump. Since the election of 2020 and the events that followed, including a violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, Christie has become one of Trump's fiercest critics and unsuccessfully challenged him in this year's primary elections. I sat down with Governor Christie this week before a live audience at Arizona State University to track the arc of his journey from ally and advisor to outspoken foe. He talks about their ruptured relationship, offers fascinating insights into the now thrice-nominated Trump and his capture of the Republican Party. Welcome to all of you. And Governor, here's the good news. Today's the Arizona primary. You made it to the Arizona primary. You're on the ballot.
I am.
You're just not a candidate anymore.
That's right. Vote early and often, as we do in New Jersey.
I want to start by talking about a particular moment in this very eloquent speech you made when you withdrew from the race earlier this year in New Hampshire, and your wife, Mary Pat, is here. I told you at that time that I saw you sitting there, and I saw you very obviously filled with pride as he gave this speech. But you did something that is unusual in politics, which is you were reflective about things, decisions you had made in the past, and you talked about the corrupting nature of ambition. Tell me about that and why you decided to include that in your speech. You talked about your decision in 2016 when you ended that race.
Yep. I think that when we were getting out of the race, it was a difficult decision to get out because we felt so strongly about the reasons that we originally got in. And the job wasn't finished. But at the other, on the other side, as David understands being in this business for a long time, when you come to the conclusion that you can't win, this is hard when you think you can win running for president. But when you ultimately look at things and say, I can't win, it makes it much harder to get out of bed in the morning. It makes it much harder to get on the phone and ask people to donate money. It makes it much harder to be able to look voters in the eye and be able to make the case, because in your heart, you already know that it's not going to happen. So once you make that decision, then you have to figure out, how do I get out? And to me, in this one, I just really felt, David, that I needed to explain to people how I had evolved over this period of 8 years and why.
And because you were the Donald Trumps.
I've known Donald Trump for 22 years. And I would say that in most of those years, I considered him a friend. Now, not like a close friend, but certainly like, you know, a business friend.
Yeah. I think probably not so much anymore, huh?
No. I haven't heard from him, not directly lately. I think it was really important to be honest with people about how this happens, so they could also judge the other people who are still in the race and understand what they were doing and not be fooled by it. So to say that, like, look, if I look back on in 2016, I acted in what was a conventional political way, which you say, when you're getting out of a race, you look at it and say, who's most likely to win? I'll get behind that person. I'll try to make them a better candidate. And if they win, make them a better president. It was okay, I think, to make those kind of decisions if the person is not horribly flawed. And I understood even then, as someone who was, I don't think I completely understood at that moment just how flawed he was and is, but I certainly had indications of it. And I said, well, but look, it's going to be him or Hillary Clinton. I don't want Hillary Clinton to be president. So I rationalized it. But what I realize in retrospect is the rationalization of significant character flaws is never acceptable.
I remember watching you, because you were the first sort of establishment Republican to stand up and say, I'm with him. And I remember that press conference, because I forget exactly what he said. You probably remember. But there was this image of you standing there, and he was saying something that he clearly shouldn't have said. And you thinking, what am I doing here?
Well, I had that feeling a number of times. Yeah. People said, well, you supported Trump. I'm like, well, let's be clear. He was not my first choice. I was my first choice.
Yeah.
That didn't work out. So it was, you know, David Cameron, the former prime minister of Great Britain, asked me one time to explain our system. And I said, look, the best way to explain it to you is that in America, we don't always get to vote for who we want to vote for. We get to vote for who's left. And I really looked at 2016 that way. Well, who's left? I thought they were both horribly flawed people. And I went with my team. And what I was trying to express in the speech was to say to people, you shouldn't accept that. When someone shows you that they're not just someone you disagree with, that's fine. That's our system. When they show you that they have such severe character flaws that you wonder about whether you can really trust them to make decisions that are really in the country's best interest and not in their own personal interest, then whatever uniform you're wearing can't be relevant in that judgment, because we have to be, you know, Americans before we're Republicans or Democrats or independents.
Yeah. It's not the usual thing. I mean, for most politicians, power, self-preservation are kind of the norm, the instinct for that. And we're seeing that now. You see a lot of people who have been openly and maybe less openly critical of President Trump now coming forward in just the way you did.
Yeah, look, except I think, and this may be somewhat self-serving, but it can be both self-serving and correct. They know a lot more than I did. I mean, they've now seen him.
You knew him.
I've been fortunate enough to get to know every president since Bush 41. And some of them I voted for and some of them I didn't. But what I would say about all of them before Donald Trump was that the presidency made them better people. That in my evaluation of them as a person, forget as a politician or a policymaker, as a person, when they left, they were better. The awesome responsibility, accountability, majesty of the job lifted them and made them better people at the end than they were when they walked in the door. In my lifetime of the presidents I've known, the only one that hasn't happened to is Donald Trump. So part of what I thought was, he'll get better. Like when he gets in the job, he'll...
Well, a lot of people said that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was a logical thing to assume. That turned out to be wrong. My problem with guys like Tim Scott in particular, and others in my party now, is they know. There's like no argument about this anymore, that like the office will elevate him. He's learned from his mistakes. You know, he'll get smarter. He's 78. He's not getting smarter. This is it. He's capped out. And so I was wrong and admitted I was wrong and admitted that I was driven by the normal conventions of ambition in politics. But I didn't know how bad he'd be. I really did. I didn't know that he would incite a riot on Capitol Hill to try to stop the peaceful transfer of power. I didn't know he would suggest
that wasn't in your transition plan.
It was not.
No.
We didn't think that would be appropriate. I didn't know he would everything from like the worst in the world, which in my mind is January 6th, to the abject stupidity of standing up during COVID, you know, and telling people not to wear masks and telling people that maybe if we inject bleach or put bright sunlight into your body, it will kill it. Like, that's ridiculous.
But you were still on the team at the end of the campaign. So you knew all of that and you were prepping him for debates, Joe Biden.
I was. Again, because I know Joe Biden. And I didn't think he was all that great an alternative either. And my view of it at the time was, all right, you asked me to prep for the debates, I'll do it. We had a much more strained relationship at that point, because I had been out of office then for almost 4 years. I had been on TV. I'd been criticizing him fairly regularly. And he watches all of that, as you know, and reacts in real time to it. I can't tell you how many times I got off ABC and in my ride on Sunday morning from New York back to New Jersey, my cell phone ring, it would be the president of the United States, who you thought would have something better to do.
He watches a lot of TV.
Yeah. Everything is about TV. If it's not on TV, it's never happened. And I mean, this is a guy who, I guess, did prep him for debates. And what I learned very early on in 2016 was to never give him anything in writing because he doesn't read. I'm not saying he can't read. He chooses not to read. And he will not be briefed in any conventional way. And the best you can do is do it verbally.
You told an interesting story in your book about your interplay with him around the possibility of you becoming chief of staff. And you went in there fully warned. James Baker, one of the legendary chiefs of staff, gave you explicit advice about how to approach the thing. You went in there, you made your demands essentially explicit. The only thing he turned down was controlling his media appearances.
Not his media, mine.
Oh, your media.
So
he would control your media appearances. Mm-hmm. I see. But then you don't even get home. And what happened?
He leaked it. All right. So we have this private meeting during the Christmas season of 2018. He's about to fire General Kelly as chief of staff. He had told me that he was going to ask me to be attorney general. And then he appointed Bill Barr. And so I'm like, okay, whatever. And he then calls and says, I have something better. Okay, come down and talk to me. So we come down and I have a meeting with he and Melania. It's just three of us in the yellow oval room mm-hmm. upstairs in the residence. So I called before I went down there. I kind of figured he was chief of staff. And so I called James Baker. He, at that time, was 92 years old. He had no idea what I was calling him about. He took the call and I said, Mr. Secretary, I need some advice from you. I have a meeting at the White House later today. And Baker said, well, Governor, if you're calling me about that, you're about to be offered the worst goddamn job in Washington. And he then gave me a list, as David alluded to, of 8 things that I should demand from Trump in order to take the job. And he said, with him, there's a 9th thing. You have to have your own personal lawyer who's paid for by the RNC from the minute you walk in the door. He said, and this was his quote, because this son of a bitch is going to ask you to do things that are illegal. And he said, and you need to keep your head about you at all times and have a lawyer who will keep you on beam. Because I can tell you from being in that job, it is disorienting. And you can get yourself turned around 8 ways mm-hmm. and you forget where the hell the line is. And he said, and you need someone who's going to be protecting your interests alone. The one thing he refused, he agreed to all that, by the way. The one thing I said was, I control my own media appearances. Like, I decide when I go on TV and when I don't. He said, oh, absolutely not. Those are my decisions. I said, Mr. President, I'm not telling you that I won't do it if you ask me, but if I'm trying to execute a strategy for you, the way chiefs of staff get in trouble are when they're too much chief and not enough staff. And you start being on TV too much, you start to think you're the president. I said, I'm going to be working behind the scenes for you to set things up. And if you say to me one day, I want you on TV and I'm working a behind the scenes deal for you, it'll ruin it if I get on TV and get asked about mm-hmm. it. So I want to control that. That's a non-starter, Chris. I'll give you the other 8.
Yeah, because he approaches it as we talked about the other day, a casting director, as a television producer, mm-hmm. as a reality show.
It is. And he says to me, you'd be a great chief of staff. You're right out of central casting. He said, you're smart, you're tough, you're articulate. It's exactly what we need going into a reelect year.
And it said the same thing to you about Mike Pence.
Right. When I was in the final 2 to be vice president, it was me or Mike Pence. And when he called me to tell me he was picking Pence, he said, Chris, look, you can't blame me, right? He said, I mean, Pence is right out of central casting. He looks like a vice president.
Who do you think that he sees as the vice presidential role for this particular production?
Never forget that he is also very practical, transactional. There's nothing philosophical about him. So I think that in his best world, what he'd like to do is pick Sarah Sanders.
His former press secretary, now governor of Arkansas.
Yeah, because Sarah has proven her loyalty. She was willing to stand behind that podium and say completely absurd things with a straight face and not give in. That's what he wants more than anything else. But he's also afraid he may not get elected, which I think is what will lead him to pick Tim Scott. I think he wants someone who can help him appeal to African-American voters. He wants someone who he thinks can, this is him now, not me, look the part sitting across from Kamala Harris. And so if you gun to my head today, this will probably kill Tim's chances when David releases this, because it'll be like, Christie thinks it should be Tim Scott, the hell with it. But so I might be doing Tim the greatest favor of his life. But I think ultimately, David, he makes a practical political judgment and decides on Tim Scott. But it's Trump, so who knows?
I just want to push back on you a little bit, because given everything that you've said about Donald Trump, and given what we've learned subsequently, but we knew an awful lot back in 2020. You said he was a failure as a president. I'm sure you had some of those doubts back then. But you say, well, you know, against Joe Biden. I guess my view, and we've discussed it, is table stakes for being president should be that you believe and uphold the rules and laws and norms and institutions of democracy. That is a distinguishing factor between him and Joe Biden, is it not?
Yeah. Look, like, beyond admitting I was wrong, I can't do a whole lot more than that.
No, okay, all right, okay.
But, like, look, you know, but I think the country is telling you right now, it's a close call.
Yes.
These two are so terribly flawed in completely different ways. And in the end, my view is that Trump is the more flawed character, because his flaws, to me, are moral flaws, which are irreparable. But I also think that if Joe Biden and his family put the country first, but even worse yet, put him first. If I were Joe Biden's son, I would put my arm around him and say, Dad, you did an amazing thing stopping Donald Trump from getting a second term. And the country will always be in your debt for doing that. But it is time to go home. And I think if Joe Biden had announced a year ago, I've done everything I could, I passed these various things, give his, you know, resume as he sees it, and he's earned it, and said, I always said I was a transitional figure, and for the future of the country, I'm not going to seek re-election. I think he would have become one of the most popular presidents in the modern history of this country, and I think the American people would have carried him out of the White House on their shoulders. And I think he is missing an enormous opportunity.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, back to the show.
Let's talk about the debate prep, because the thing that was notable about the debate prep, I mean, it was the typical, as you describe it, crazy kind of free-form exchange that passed for debate prep with Trump, but it was in the midst of the worst of the pandemic. You and six others, I guess, were prepping him, and no one wore masks.
We had to wear masks coming into the White House. We all had to be tested when we came in. We had to wait in the Eisenhower building till our test results came back to make sure we were negative before we were allowed to go to the West Wing. We all went over there with our masks on. We went into the East Wing, to the map room, which is where we were doing debate prep. And we went into the room. He was not there yet. So he comes into the room from having played golf. And I said, we all have masks on. I said, Mr. President, it's up to you. Are we wearing masks in here or are we not? And he said, you've all tested negative. You can take the masks off. So we took the masks off. What he knew that none of us knew at that moment was that morning he had tested positive. And none of us knew it. The only people who knew it were the White House physician, Mark Meadows, his chief of staff, and Trump. And we then went through 4 days where I was sitting as close to him as I am to David, and I was in charge, and I was playing Joe Biden. I want you to take that home with you. And sitting across from him and having vigorous arguments, as you would in an appropriate debate prep. And he never told me. Now, who's in that room? Oh, it's a bunch of like people he doesn't know. Oh, no. Me, his campaign manager, Bill Stepien, Kellyanne Conway, Hope Hicks, Stephen Miller, and Jason Miller, who is still his kind of press aide. Mm-hmm. So there were 7 of us total in the room. Donald Trump was the first one who got visibly sick of the 6 of us was Hope Hicks. And this is the difference between Donald Trump and Hope Hicks, for instance. When Hope got sick, she called every one of us and said, I've got COVID and I have active symptoms. You guys need to go and get tested. And I turned out to be the last one to get symptoms. I was done on Tuesday with him. I wound up getting symptoms on Friday and then wound up in the hospital in the intensive care unit for 7 days. At a time when there were no treatments, including a vaccine. And basically, they didn't know what to do. They would hold up whiteboards to the window with questions. And then I would write on a whiteboard back and hold it up. My family was not allowed to come to the hospital or to see me. And it was a really, really scary 7 days. You know, I'm just lucky that, you know, what happened was my wife was working like crazy to try to get some of the experimental treatments for me. And Eli Lilly had a monoclonal antibody cocktail that they were experimenting with that had not even been approved for experimental treatment. And she got the CEO of Eli Lilly on the phone and said, Chris is really sick. He needs this. And the folks from Eli Lilly got a truck, a van, and they drove the medicine from Indianapolis overnight to New Jersey to give me the chance to try this thing. And I really believe it's what saved my life because my values were going down for the 3 days before I got this. I got this. They stabilized.
These were the treatments that the president himself was getting at Walter Reed at the time. Now, there was a moment there when you talked to your wife as you wrote that you were going to be potentially intubated or you feared that and you knew you wouldn't be able to talk and you wanted to talk to your kids thinking it might be the last time.
Sure. I said to her, I said, look, you know, because the doctors have come in and said to me, if you don't get better, start stabilizing by tomorrow, we're going to have to intubate you. And so I called Mary Pat and I said, look, you need to talk to the doctors and tell them that we have to have a 1 hour warning absent an emergency before they intubate me. I said, because I want 15 minutes with each of our kids because there's things I need to say to them that I may never get the chance. So when you get to that point, you know, like nothing else really matters. And so, you know, that's the state I was in. And to raise the mood here a bit, I will tell you that, on the first night I was in the hospital, I got a phone call. My cell phone rang. It was Donald Trump. Now, understand, at this point, I did not know that he had COVID when he sat across from me. I didn't find that out till a year later. He never told any of us. So he knows, though. He knows. He's at Walter Reed, sick. He calls me and he says, how are you? And I said, not good. Not good. You don't sound good either. He goes, oh, no, this is a bitch. He said, Chris, can you believe this? two tough guys like me and you. This virus is knocking us out. This is ridiculous. The hell is this thing? I said, I don't know, Mr. President. And he said to me, let me ask you a question, though. He said, you're not going to tell the press that I gave it to you, are you? Now, I thought this is a ridiculous question. I said that to him. I said, it's ridiculous, Mr. President. I don't know who patient zero is. I don't know if it was you or Hope or Miller. I don't know who it was. So why would I blame anybody? We all got it. We're all in the same room. I don't know who patient zero was. He goes, no, you're right. That's true. But I mean, if they press you, you're not going to blame me, right? And I said, no, sir, because I have no basis to blame you. So why would I do that? He was good. Well, look, feel better. It's good talking to you. And he got off the phone. Last time I heard from him while I was sick. Now, on the flip side, his wife called me every day and called Mary Pat a number of times to ask her, like, is there anything we can do for him? Is there anything he needs from the White House position? But this guy, knowing that he'd given it to all of us, that he was patient zero, and the capper to that one, as if you're not already disgusted enough. He, of course, got sick almost before anybody but Hope. So he was out and he went back to campaign. He went on Air Force One, and as David, I'm sure, has experienced, the president sometimes goes back to the press cabin and gives a little off the record to the media. Trump did. When they landed, I got a call in the hospital from two reporters who said to me, this was off the record, so you can't use it. He said, but it's so reprehensible that I can't, we have to repeat it to you. And these were separate phone calls. And the reporter said to me, he came back and said, you gave it to him. He goes, you know, Christy, he was sitting across from me at debate prep. He was spitting and everything. I'm sure I got it from him, when he knew that the exact opposite was true. And had come and asked me, while I'm in the ICU, you're not going to blame me, are you? And then turned around and he blamed me. So, you know.
So this must have irritated you.
It bothered me. It really ended the relationship because we really didn't talk again after that. I wasn't involved in any more debate prep for him after that. There was another debate. I chose not to be involved in prepping him for that. And it pretty much was the end of it.
Let me ask you, how much of this entered into your thinking when you thought about running for president, knowing that you'd be running against him?
Very little. In terms of the personal thing, okay.
Guy almost killed you.
Right.
That seems personal.
It is. And I'm making a distinguishing between the two. If I ran against him because he gave me COVID, that campaign would last a very short period of time. And my motivation for that campaign, it would be transparent that it was just personal. When I decided, we decided to run again, it was because of two factors. One, how horrible he is. But two, because no one else in my party was going to say it. We were watching other candidates get into the race and their refusal to even say his name. I used to say on the campaign trail, he's like Voldemort. He who shall not be named with these other candidates. They won't even bring his name up. They're so damn scared of him. And she looked at me, Mary Pat looked at me one night and she said, you have to do this. You're the only one with the guts to do this. You've got to do it.
So let's jump in the way back machine here to the period after the midterm elections. Republican Party did poorly compared to expectations. A number of the candidates who Trump personally anointed to run for positions lost. His stock was historically low. Governor DeSantis had won in Florida. He was being hoisted as the guy who, the Trump slayer, got a lot of money. Here we are as we sit here today on the day of the Arizona primary, Illinois primary, other primaries, and he is the nominee of the Republican Party. He's already secured the nomination, despite what happened on January 6th, despite, and maybe, and you should discuss this, because of four separate criminal indictments. How do you explain that? And how do you explain what's going on in your party?
I explain it going all the way back to the immediate aftermath of him leaving office in 2021. I think there are a number of culprits who normalized his behavior. And those people, I think, have a special, in my opinion, awful place in history when we look back on this. Culprit number one is Kevin McCarthy. When he went down to Mar-a-Lago weeks after Trump left office and essentially kissed the ring, he normalized what Trump had done and is part of the reason why I said what I said in my speech, because he's another example of someone who put his own personal ambition ahead of the country. He so badly wanted to be Speaker of the House that he was willing to do anything. And that included going down and normalizing the behavior of the guy who he said on the floor of the House after January 6th that he was finished with. Culprit number two is Mitch McConnell. Because if Mitch McConnell would have voted appropriately, in my view, to remove him from office based on the January 6th activity, I am willing to bet at least another 10 Republican senators would have gone in his wake because the leader would have provided cover. And he would have been removed, quote unquote. He was already out of office. What was the import of it? He can never run again. Because once you've been convicted and removed, the Constitution prevents you from ever holding federal office again.
Now McConnell made a speech that all but concluded that he should be.
Which makes it even worse.
But how he explained it in an interview was to say, I didn't want to be the leader of five members of my caucus. He didn't. Now seven, I guess, voted. But he didn't. He believed that he would have lost his leadership if he, that was essentially what he was saying.
I believe that they were just looking for cover. And that's what a leader is supposed to provide, is leadership. And say, go this way and I'll be with you. We'll do this together. And secondly, I don't buy it because there are some things worth losing your job over. And I think one of the diseases in both parties right now is that people care more about their title than they care about what they were sent there to do. And I've always felt that way because I'm a Republican from New Jersey, which means like you're an endangered species from the minute you wake up in the morning. And so you have to fundamentally decide like which are the things I'm willing to put my career on the line for. But to make that decision, you have to first decide if there's anything that you're willing to do it. Culprit number three is Rick Scott, the senator from Florida, who within 2 weeks after he left office, went to Mar-a-Lago and presented him with a plaque, calling him the NRSC Man of the Year, even though we lost the United States Senate because of Donald Trump. Like, it's just absolutely mind-numbing to me. And I think those three helped the beginning of that cycle you're talking about leading into 22.
But my question is less about the leaders who normalized his behavior than the voters and where your party is at. You just wrote a book called What Would Reagan Do? But this isn't Ronald Reagan's Republican Party anymore. It's an isolationist party. It's a xenophobic party. It's not just Trump, but Trump is appealing to something. And in some ways, Trump has woven a narrative in which these indictments have helped him within the Republican electorate. Well, so talk to me about where your party is at.
The party demographically has changed. It used to be the Democratic Party was the working class party, the less formally educated party. And that used to be the strength of the Democratic Party. And the Republican Party was more the more college educated, affluent party. It's completely flipped. The Democrats are now the more affluent, the more college-educated party. And the Republicans, in the main, have become the party of more high school degree or less and, you know, working class salaries and wealth. Look, both parties have a responsibility for what's going on in terms of the anger of the country. I think Trump is both an accelerant and a symptom of what's going on in the country. There's a lot of anger. I mean, I looked at a poll recently in the state of Colorado where the people who say that they will vote for Joe Biden no matter what, blizzard on election day, they're out for Biden. You know what Donald Trump's favorable, unfavorable rating is among those voters? 199.
And that's plus or minus four. He could be at negative three.
He could be at negative three. Yeah. Or he could be at five, right? And then to say it's a symptom of both parties, the people who are the Trump supporters who say they'll vote for Trump no matter what, their fave on fave of Biden is 198. What that means to me as someone who's been in this business for a long time is all of this is driven by anger. Not philosophy, not issues. It's anger. And Republican voters believe that both the elite in their party, referring to
you,
me, the George W. Bush, the George H.W. Bush, the that era of Ronald Reagan, that era of leaders, screwed them and sold them out to foreign interests for trade and for other things. And this is not the America we used to have. And they have been strong enough against the Democrats who they believe are undercutting the traditional moral values of this country. Democrats, angry Democrats on the far left of the Democratic Party, are taking a wholly different approach. I mean, I never thought I'd see a Democratic Party that is in large measure anti-Israel.
Yeah.
Well. I mean, it just is. And like Joe Biden is holding the ramparts, but then he has Chuck Schumer go on the floor of the United States Senate this week and give what I consider to be a wholly outrageous speech. You could get on the floor and say, I disagree with Benjamin Netanyahu. I disagree with his policies. I think they're bad for Israel. I think they're bad for the world. Perfectly acceptable. For Chuck Schumer to say, the Israelis need to change their government. We wouldn't stand for that, coming from anybody else. But here's the difference. We have the checkbook. And Israel knows that they cannot, literally cannot survive without the American checkbook. When the highest elected Jewish leader in this country goes out and says that, there's only one explanation for it, in my mind. And the explanation is he knows they got problems on their left flank. And the only way to, you know, have the pro-Hamas, pro-Gaza wing of the Democratic Party not go into full revolt, not vote for Joe Biden, is to show they're willing to push back in the other direction. So you have hardly cynical.
Let me just, because I don't want to get into a long debate about the Middle East. I got a lot of other things that I need to talk to you about. But let me speak as a non-elected Jew, the son of an immigrant from the pogrom. So I feel very strongly about Israel. It is possible to have two thoughts at once. It is possible to be absolutely appalled and outraged about the massacre that happened on October 7th. And I feel that. And I think anybody with a beating heart should feel that that was savagery.
No, it was justified. But, listen to members of the left.
Well, no.
Rationalization.
Let me make my point here.
Right.
It is possible to hold that thought and also to be completely agonized, heartbroken, and maybe even outraged about the collateral damage that of tens of thousands of innocent people, not Hamas, to see people starving, children starving. This is a terrible situation. And you talk to military people, and I do, and our military people, and they say there are more surgical ways to accomplish what the Israelis are accomplishing. I think that the thrust of Schumer's statement was right. I agree with you that I would have left out the piece, it's not up to us to say when they should have elections. I think that, and Netanyahu being the skillful politician and crafty politician that he is, he's also trying to stay out of prison. And as long as he's prime minister, he can, has now seized on this. He went before the Knesset today and said, we're not going to let the Americans just tell us what to do. So he's making the most of it. But there is a humanitarian disaster going on there now, and it is tearing it is tearing a lot of people apart. And it's not just a function of the left-wing Democrats. I think a lot of Americans and a lot of people around the world are concerned about it.
I, as am I, and I've been there and I've seen it. I don't disagree with you. But that's not what I criticized. What I criticized was it's blackmail. Don't look at it any other way. Chuck Schumer is blackmailing the Israeli government. The implication of his statement that you must now hold new elections is, and it, what's the or else?
Well,
the American government is the only one who can do an or else to Israel. And what I'm offended by, more dramatically than I am by anything else that Chuck Schumer said, because most of the rest of it I agree with. But if Israel's greatest ally in the world is willing to have one of its highest elected officials publicly blackmail the government for political purposes, and that's what it is, Schumer doesn't need to say any of this publicly. He could pick up the phone and call Netanyahu, which I'm sure he has, and say to him, hey, Bibi, you guys don't ratchet this thing back. You're going to put us in an impossible position, and we're not going to be able to help you. This was an appeal by Schumer to appeal to the disaffected left wing of his party to try to bring them back into the fold for the election this fall. It's politics, but it's gross politics.
We are Israel's greatest ally, and we provide their qualitative military edge. That's been true since 1948.
Okay, yep.
But that also means that we're supplying a lot of the weaponry that is now being used for the heavy bombing that we've seen. So we have a responsibility to make our views known about how this weaponry is being used.
Please do.
But I just did.
Well, right. You and I agree.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
And now, back to the show.
Let's talk about Ukraine, because you went and visited Zelensky during the campaign. Tell me about that experience, and tell me exactly, this is where you get to the party of Reagan and the party that you have now.
I went to Ukraine because I felt like if you want to be president of the United States, I believe it is an existential threat to our safety and security. And I think you need to go on the ground and see it for yourself. I was in one of the cities that was early on attacked by the Russian army, and the mayor survived this attack on his city. And he was giving me the tour of the city in Ukraine. They took me to a neighborhood where it looked kind of like Brooklyn. There were a bunch of row houses. And they were all empty now. And he said to me, you know what happened in those houses? And he said, the Russian army came through. They went into the houses and they dragged out of the houses any males that were in the house of whatever age, children or adult males. They dragged them out onto the sidewalk in front of their house, cut off their ears, gouged out their eyes while they were alive, and then shot them in the back of the head and killed them. And the import of it was no one will hear what happened here and no one will see what happened here. Then they went inside the homes and they raped all the women, starting with the youngest, so that the older women would have to watch their children, grandchildren, or nieces be raped by Russian soldiers. If America doesn't stand up against that, then we're not worth anything. And that's who Putin is. And he sends his soldiers into that meat grinder and has hundreds of thousands of them killed. And he didn't care because life means nothing to him. And when you then go into the presidential offices in Kyiv, where there is burlap over all the windows, no lights on in the building, sandbags at every entrance to try to slow down any Russians that may be trying to come in. And you meet in a dim-lit room with the president of this country. And the first thing he said to me when he walked into the room after welcome was, "Promise me you'll do two things for me." I said, "What's that, Mr. President?" He said, "First, when you're in front of any group of American people, please tell them I said thank you, that we would already be under the Russian thumb if it wasn't for America having sent us aid so immediately. And two, tell them I will never permit an American soldier into my country. We can win this war and want to win this war on our own. And all we need from you is to help arm us, and we will defeat them." This is a guy of real leadership. He's not perfect, like any leader is not perfect. But remember what Joe Biden said to him on the second day of the invasion. He said, "We can send helicopters for you and your family." And Zelensky's response was, "Mr. President, I don't need helicopters. I need guns." And so he had a choice whether to walk out, and he didn't. And I think that what my party, and a small portion of my party, but a controlling portion of my party, is doing in Congress right now is indefensible.
So this, just to dive deeper into this, there was a bill. It included aid, a national security bill, aid for Ukraine, aid for Israel, and border security, and including some very strict changes in immigration law and procedure. That was the toughest that we've seen in decades, negotiated by James Lankford from Oklahoma, one of the most conservative members of the Senate. It was on track to pass the United States Senate, and then Donald Trump spoke. Tell me about that. What was your reaction to that? And what did you saw people who on every one of those things have been outspoken, a guy like Lindsey Graham, for example, who pulled off of the bill.
Yeah.
And the speaker said he will never, as part of that, the speaker said, "I'll never allow a vote on this bill."
Yeah. Look, in our system, the way it's operating at the moment, the guy who's in charge is the guy who's in charge. And these people are scared of Trump and they don't want to cross him. And they understand that politically, what will happen to them is they will get primaried and defeated. And this goes back to the conversation that we were just having earlier about McConnell. Like, what's worth losing your job over? And it seemed to me this is something that rises that level. It also, the bill also included really important military aid for Taiwan as well, which is the next frontier that we're going to have to be dealing with. So, David, I can only explain it very simply as political cowardice. That's all it is. You know, they know what the right thing to do is. Lindsey Graham in particular knows what the right thing to do is. And John McCain, since I'm sitting in Arizona, is spinning in his grave that his friend, the person he mentored through his whole career, Lindsey Graham, cares more about playing golf at Doral than he cares about Ukraine. And that's the only thing I can conclude from what he's doing. And to go through the BS of let's turn it into a loan rather than aid, like, please, you know, like, and Lindsey trying to protect himself that way. I don't think anybody who thinks rationally buys it. But it tells you the level of control Trump has. And that's why I ran the way I did. Because if you don't break it, it's going to continue.
Give him credit for this much, though. Give him credit for honesty, because he said, look, if we pass this bill, it'll be a gift to the Democrats and let them off the hook on the border, and we need this issue in November.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a new mess. Donald Trump is personally motivated and cynical. Stop the presses. I mean, you know, like, that's the whole point, is that the balancing of the branches of government is supposed to be about stopping that. It's not that the founders did it that way because they knew everyone was impure.
Now we're going to get to the nitty gritty.
Okay.
These cases, these legal cases, they have helped Trump within the party, just as he sold the idea that the last election was stolen. He sold the idea that these indictments were part of a deep state reprisal to keep him from becoming president. Are any of these trials, now I'm asking you as a former U.S. attorney, are any of these trials going to go before November?
Yeah, I think at least the New York trial will go.
Which is the state, the local trial based on
hush money to Stormy Daniels.
And the hiding of the felony, though, that is that he tried to hide the...
He deducted it.
Yeah, yeah.
As legal fees to Michael Cohen.
Yes.
That's the cooking of the books is the felony.
What about the federal trials, particularly the January 6th trial? Because that one, it seems to me, and you can opine on this, that seems to me to be the most troubling for him amid a sea of trouble.
It's the most damaging fact pattern, and it has the most damaging collection of witnesses, because most of the witnesses are Republicans who used to work for him. So the people who say it's a deep state creation and all the rest of this stuff are going to have as witness number one, Mark Meadows, his former chief of staff, under a grant of immunity where he will testify, I am confident, that he committed crimes at Trump's behest and that Trump committed crimes in his presence. That's hardly something you can blame on Joe and Mika or Joy Reid or any of the other MSNBC crowd. I mean, it's the one of the founders of the Freedom Caucus who's going to be up there as his former chief of staff testifying against him. Now, the Supreme Court took the case. I think that was a jump ball as to whether they were going to take it or not. I think they did take it because it is a really important issue. The idea, because there has to be some level of presidential immunity. You know, you can't, you know, Barack Obama, when he was president, I think rightfully ordered a number of drone strikes. If someone can come back and say, we want to prosecute Barack Obama for murder because he ordered these drone strikes, I don't think that's what we want the president of the United States exposed to that. So there's got to be some contours of it. And I think the Supreme Court probably took it for that. The import of that, though, is on your question.
They delay the whole thing.
They delay the whole thing. And that's Trump's strategy. I still think that case can happen. I think it is purely, you'll have a decision by the end of June at the latest. I suspect you'll have it earlier. The arguments are April 22nd. I suspect that Chief Justice Roberts is already writing this opinion. Mm-hmm. And because oral argument in appellate, I did oral argument in appellate work when I was a practicing lawyer. And I always used to say, we'd go through all these murder boards. And I'd say, this is the biggest waste of time. Because when we get in front of them, they already know what they're doing. They just afford us the opportunity to make the argument. I think they're probably got the outlines of what they're going to do. Almost.
So you think that, and you think they'll rule quickly?
I do. Mm-hmm. I think they probably rule before the end of June. Mm-hmm. And then Judge Chutkan's got to decide. That would probably
the judge in Washington who's handling the case.
Right. Let's say they decide in May. I think it's reasonable that she has to give them 3 months to get ready for the trial. And so she's got to decide, is she willing to do the trial in August or not? And then she's got to decide, is it right? Because this trial will take 2 months. And I can't imagine how hard it's going to be to pick a jury in Washington. It's going to take a few weeks to do that. Then probably another 6 weeks to try the case. That means a verdict probably comes in October. And he's on the ballot on November 5th. That's a tough call. For her.
It is.
It's a tough call. Now, I think that a majority of the American people would prefer to know the answer to the question over their
That's what polling suggests.
Yeah. And so I don't think she'll be swayed at all by the polling. I think she's going to decide, do they have a fair enough time to get ready? Can I get a jury? Can I do all this? And can I get this done before Election Day? The other problem with this, David, last point, not to get too wonky on this, is that Trump has to be in court every day. So the impact on his campaigning is going to be significant because he's out on bail, let's not forget. And one of the restrictions on his bail is he must be physically present for any court proceeding. So once the trial starts, it's not like he can go, call me when you need me.
He seems to be pretty adroit at campaigning from the steps of courthouses. He's had a lot of practice. Just real quick, third parties are likely to play a role in this race. As you point out, it's very close. It's probably going to be very close because we're a very polarized country right to the end. And in 2016, the third parties, I think, helped Trump in that election. I think that that could be the case again, but we have a number of different parties. One of the parties that is at least notionally going to be on the ballot is the No Labels Party. I think they may be on the ballot in Arizona already. Your name has come up as a potential nominee. It's a weird process. I don't know if it's what you call a draftee or whatever. Is that something that you are considering?
You know, I think the way I would look at it is I will do whatever I can to try to make sure that the country doesn't go through what I think will be the misery of a second Trump term. Now, there's a lot between actually running yourself and nothing. But I wouldn't preclude anything at this point, David. I would just say that there are a number of hurdles to get over before I would actually consider running as a third party.
Do you think a third party candidate could actually, no third party candidate in the modern really
ever. Really.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt ran in 1912. He got 27% of the vote. I think he got 90 or 88 electoral votes. He was the most successful third party candidate. So you're not going to elect a No Labels president. Then doesn't it become a question of who would it help and who would it hurt?
Well, I don't think you can really game that out 7 months before an election. I think if you try to, you're kidding yourself. You and I both know this. Polls change. And the difference here is that we've got the most unsettled political terrain we've ever had. You have an 81-year-old Democratic nominee who, if he fell over, and I'm not wishing this because I like Joe Biden personally. Mary Pat and I have known him. We've known him for 40 years. So I like Joe Biden on a personal level. But would it shock anybody if he went up to a podium tomorrow and like fell over? It wouldn't. I mean, I don't wish that on him at all. I wish nothing but the best for him. But you've got that type of problem with him. And with Trump, you've got 4 indictments. By the way, by next Monday, he's got to post $454 million.
Yeah.
Or Letitia James can start seizing his properties.
You think this is the cruelest cut of all to him?
Oh, there will be. He would rather be drawn and quartered than to be shown he's really not as rich as he says he is. And look, I would think most people, even in this audience, before all this started, if I came up to you and said, if gun to his head, could Donald Trump write a $400 million check? That a majority of people would think he probably could, the way he talks about his wealth. But what you're seeing right now proves he can't. He can't, because if he could, he would. So with all that terrain out there that's unsettled, with the fact that he could wind up getting convicted once, maybe twice, and all the polling I've seen says that that affects about a third of the voters, that if he's convicted, they'd say, I would reconsider whether to vote for him or not if he's actually convicted of a crime. Only thing I'd say about a third party effort is we've never had a set of circumstances like this before. 2 guys combined 160, 1 indicted 4 times, 1 who on his worst days doesn't look like he's up to the job, and a Democratic Party that is divided about him, and a Republican Party who at least 20%, if not more, of our members won't vote for him. So that seems to me like something where a third-party candidate could be potentially viable. And everything is unprecedented until it happens. So everybody says, well, this is unprecedented. Well, it's unprecedented that a former president's under 4 indictments. I remember my first vote was for Ronald Reagan in 1980, and he was 69 years old, and the country was in a tizzy. Then he was the oldest person ever to be elected president. And how could he function at 69 years old, right? These guys lapped that quite some time ago. So all I'd say about third party stuff is, do I think it's likely a third party candidate could be elected president? No, I don't think it's likely. Do I think it's possible? I think in this environment, anything's possible. But I would end that answer with this. You get what you deserve.
Well, I think given everything that you've said about Trump during this hour, I think that the notion of who casting a third party vote for him, there may be people on the Republican side who feel the same way about Biden. Seems like a serious calculation, though. If it looks like the race is between the two of them and a third party vote isn't going to make the difference, you're not going to elect a third party candidate. People are going to have to make that judgment too. Let me ask you, just going out, two things. One is, how has this whole experience changed you? Because I remember you were a pretty brash son of a gun when you were governor. You were sort of Trump before Trump was cool in some ways, in that you were.
I was cool. Trump isn't. But no, look, it hasn't changed me all that much. The circumstances around me have changed. But I do think that the essence of who I am hasn't really changed. I think that what time teaches you, David, and has taught me, is that, you know, judgment matters. Ambition is not everything. And who you are when you put your head on the pillow at night is important. And when you get into the swirl of this business, you can lose that. And there have been moments when I have. But I think the older I get, the better my judgment is on that. And you try to tack. The one thing I don't want to ever lose, and I think, you know, anybody who's been successful in this business, if you don't have it, you're not going to be successful, is you got to also be willing to be daring and risky and take chances. You know, your most famous client got into the race 30, 40 points, maybe more, behind Hillary Clinton, who was supposed to be the runaway nominee in 2008. And if Barack Obama just, you know, listened to conventional wisdom, he would probably still be in the United States Senate from Illinois and probably a fairly miserable guy at that. And so some of these things, you also can't lose that edge that says, I have something to offer. I know I might not win, but the risk is worth it. And so that's where I've tried to balance, David, the mellowing that comes with age and the wisdom that comes with that, but not lose the kind of the brashness and the confidence that gives you the ability to take risk, because that risk can be really beneficial for you and for the people that you want to serve. And so it's a constant kind of balancing act. And I'm going through that every day in the aftermath of this race to figure out what I want to do next with my life. And that's always a challenge. And it's one today.
Well, one risk that I can't afford taking is continuing the conversation because we're out of time. But Governor Christie, thank you so much.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Axe Files, brought to you by the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Miriam Fender Annenberg. The show is also produced by Sarah-Lena Berry, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Steve Lichtai and Haley Thomas. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.